You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
China's Uyghur minority are ethnically Turkic Muslims with roots in Central Asia. Human rights groups have been accusing the Chinese government of systematically crushing the Uyghur culture and limiting their religious freedom. Beijing says it's just cracking down on a Uyghur separatist movement. With me now for the first of today's underreported segments are Sharon Hom, Executive Director of Human Rights in China, an international Chinese NGO. Also, sociologist Blaine Kaltman joins us. He's the author of a recent book from Ohio University Press called Under the Heel of the Dragon, Islam, Racism, Crime, and the Uyghur in China. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to the show. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
So how many Uyghurs?
Thank you for having us.
How many Uyghurs are there in China, Blaine?
There's about 8 million of them.
And are they ethnically unique?
They are. They're Turkic. They're Muslim. They combine, their faces combine Indo and Iranian features. I mean, they look as different from the Han Chinese as, you know, as we do, or as blacks do from whites. They are ethnically unique.
And Sharon, they're mostly Muslim?
Yes, they are, although there are other, you know, Muslim is the vast majority.
What's their language like? It's a non-Chinese language?
Yes, it's not Putonghua. It's their own language.
So it's not written with Chinese characters?
No, not at all.
Are there?
In fact, it's written with Arabic characters.
Yeah.
Are there any cultural affinities between the Han Chinese and the Uyghurs? That you know. In other words, I mean, we've been talking about all the differences. Are there similarities in any ways? I'm assuming that there has been some kind of intermarriage over the years, and there have been other ways that the groups have connected, because that's just the way humans are.
There's been that, but what has been more prominent is a very conscious state policy to assimilate and precisely to undermine the preservation of cultural and ethnic and religious identity. So I think it's really been the other way. It's that it's been very difficult for these groups, including the Uyghurs, to preserve their own identity.
Well, how do they wind up living within China? Has it always been a part of China?
Historically, the area of East Turkestan,
which is what the Uyghurs call their area,
yeah.
The Chinese
call
it something
else. So it's not
that
they became, you know, part of China. There's a long historical record of, one could say, occupation and colonization in these areas. And these areas, the historic areas, are much broader. What is known today in part as the XUAR, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and the Tibet Autonomous Region, and the Mongol Autonomous Region, were not historically, though the Chinese, of course, claim historically, were a part of the Chinese pre 20th century empire.
So this is similar to the situation in Tibet, in that after Mao came to power, he solidified control over this area?
Well, it's similar. Human Rights in China issued a report on Tibetans, Uyghurs, and Mongols back in the spring, and that's available on our website, hrichina.org, where we looked at these three groups. And what is similar about these three groups is that political participation, the development, equitable development, and sharing equitably in the benefits of the economic growth, and the preservation of cultural, religious identity have been a serious, serious problem and a violation of human rights across the board for these groups.
Well, Blaine, we mentioned that they live in an autonomous region. What does that mean? How much control over the area that the Chinese government calls Xinjiang, how much control does the Chinese government exert?
Well, the Chinese government has attempted to create a ruling class in Xinjiang of Uyghur loyal to Beijing. And this has, some would argue, mostly been brought about through bribery, offering Uyghurs an opportunity for power and money that most Uyghur who live at or beneath the poverty line could barely imagine. The problem is there's an absolute absence of Uyghur authority at the highest ruling levels of government. You know, they are represented, but they don't really have a lot of authority.
Now, they call their area East Turkestan. why East Turkestan? Why not East Kazakhstan, for example? Because most of the Uyghurs who live outside of China live in Kazakhstan, don't they?
Well, the Tarim Basin is Xinjiang's, you know, it's the Uyghurs' ancestral homeland. I think that that's just the way they know it. You know, I mean, between the 10th and 12th centuries, that's when their Uyghur kingdom really flourished, and that's when Uyghur tribes, which at one time were Buddhist, converted to Islam. As far as calling it Turkestan, the Uyghur regard the Turk as their ethnic origin.
My guests are Blaine Kaltman, who is the author of a book called Under the Heel of the Dragon, Islam, Racism, Crime, and the Uyghur in China, and Sharon Hom, Executive Director of Human Rights in China, which is an international Chinese NGO. And we're talking on Underreported today about the situation in what the Chinese call Xinjiang, what the Uyghurs call East Turkestan, an area that is an autonomous region, but as we are discovering, actually is just really controlled by China from Beijing. And this is similar to what China has done with minority groups living within its borders in general, Sharon?
Well, the groups that they've been targeting with respect to controlling the identity and the character of these groups are really targeting the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, and the Mongols. That's why I report. But before your point about how autonomous are these regions, I think it's important to look at the fact that the regions, these autonomous regions, have autonomy laws. And the autonomy law for the XUAR, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, really focuses very superficially on a kind of autonomy that doesn't matter. So the autonomy, the deeper ethnic identity like religion, really meaningful participation in the decisions that affect the region, like on development, etc., they don't have that capacity. The post 9/11 2001 amendments to the ethnic regional autonomy law doesn't give further political freedoms. Instead, what it does is it's focusing on improving economic function, which really disproportionately benefits the Han Chinese settlers, of course.
Now, how significant is 9/11 to this story?
The 9/11 is first the crackdowns and the attempts to control social control and political control in China generally predates 9/11. However, post 2001, a number of developments gave the Chinese government the obvious cover to say, "Well, we're fighting terrorism," and this includes both post 9/11 legislation, amendments of the criminal law to make heavier penalties for the crimes of organizing, leading, actively participating. It also launched off a number of drafting initiatives, anti-terrorism law, a state emergency law. These are all in drafting and still has not been finalized. But what it did was it created a climate in which these kinds of legislative activities, which raises very serious questions about the balance, the appropriate balance between addressing terrorist threat and, as the Chinese themselves recognize, that the proper balance between protecting freedoms and human rights, they actually do name that as one of the balances.
The Associated Press reported a couple of weeks ago that Uyghurs in Xinjiang were ordered to surrender their passports to police. Is that true?
Well, we don't have any direct corroboration of it, but I think that the overall official attempts, normally through the PSB for passport control, does limit the freedom of movement of citizens.
Blaine, go ahead.
I'm sorry. There may be a reason for this. It seems to me that there have been some police campaigns designed to reduce Uyghur crime or the potential threat of it, particularly in Urumqi, Beijing, and Shanghai, where the Uyghur they've become a minority in their ancestral homeland because of Han immigration into the region. In Beijing and Shanghai, most Uyghur have moved there looking for better opportunities, and often when they don't find them, it's true, a lot of them do turn to crime. But the campaigns in Beijing and Shanghai were focused primarily when it comes to passports on identifying and sending undesirable Uyghurs, those with no legitimate employment, home to Xinjiang.
Now, what are the popular perceptions about the Uyghurs in mainstream Chinese culture? That they're all criminals?
Well, I, 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 I would say that the Han have a generally, I mean, almost 100% of them, you know, well, not 100%, but 99% of them, certainly living outside of Xinjiang, tend to perceive the Uyghurs fierce, backward, criminal-minded. And this is whether they're a taxi driver, a waitress, a professional. It doesn't matter what their profession is. They tend to believe that. Interestingly enough,
where does that come from, Blaine?
I'm sorry?
Where does that come from? Is that because of government propaganda, or is it based on real criminal activities?
Well, I think it's a mixture. You know, I don't think it's necessarily government propaganda. I think that the Han in general, as in China, can have a bit of a superiority complex, and they've often viewed minorities as backwards and recalcitrant and uninterested in assimilating to their, in their mind, superior dominant culture.
You said you discovered that 95% of the Han you interviewed said they had no Uyghur friends.
Well, that's true, but then again, most of the Han that I interviewed don't know any Uyghur. I mean, most of the Uyghurs still are living in Xinjiang. And interestingly enough, the Han that I did interview that lived in Xinjiang, some of them did, even if they didn't have Uyghur friends, they wouldn't look down upon them the way the Han who didn't know any Uyghur would. I think part of these perceptions come from simply a lack of knowledge. A lot of Han living in Xinjiang would purchase their fruits and whatnot from Uyghur. They knew each other. They interacted on a daily basis, whereas outside of Xinjiang, they really don't. They don't interact with Uyghur. They don't see them. In fact, most of the country doesn't even have any Uyghur living in it. It's really they're concentrated in Uyghur enclaves in Beijing and Shanghai and then in Xinjiang.
Sharon?
I think the question of popular perception raises the broader question of information control, censorship, and self-censorship in China, which is really the state of the arts in the world, both in terms of the law, the technology, the police, and social apparatus. So I think that it's extremely difficult to conduct that kind of survey data, though it's very important to do. On the ideological control, it has been a clear policy of this particular regime to equate any assertion of cultural, religious, or ethnic identity, absolutely equating it in language, in rhetoric, in propaganda, in law, with terrorism, and clothing it in this really scary rhetoric of anti-terrorism, and that has been a conscious policy. With the respect to interactions between, say, Han settlers, not in the urban areas, but in the Han settlers in these autonomous regions, where they've really become the majority in some parts of XUAR in the Tibetan autonomous region, there's what you could see is like a hierarchy of marginalization, that the Han settlers who are going are of two kinds. One kind is that they're not really settlers. They're part of this major problem of the Bingtuans, that is the production brigades, what they call the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps, or better known as the Bingtuan. These are garrisoned production brigades, which in ordinary times was really an economic control, but now really serving a military function, and they are a major source of tensions with the local populations. So you have that problem, and when we think of what is going on, the bigger picture with human rights in China is that there is massive social economic dislocations when you have hundreds of millions of migrants. And so there being many of them, these migrants, at the very bottom of the left behind of the economic growth and benefits are moving into or, quote, settling into these areas. And I think that that's really one of the tensions. You're taking a group of really marginalized have-nots who have been dislocated from land and livelihoods in the interior, and they're going to these other areas where the local communities and populations are being dispossessed of land, history, culture, language, and religion.
But how much of this is also a matter of the Chinese government's unease with religion? Because we've seen tensions with Buddhists in Tibet, with Christians, with the Falun Gong, who grow out of Chinese religious ideas, Han Chinese religious mm-hmm. ideas, and in this case, the Muslims who are Uyghurs.
It is an unease, and it's not specifically with religion. It's an unease on the part of the party with any group it cannot control. So it really has to do with political control. And with a one-party authoritarian regime, they're very uncomfortable with any parts of civil society, any groups, any individual that they can't control. And therefore, hence, you see, you know, very clear directives to the media, to the journalists, what can be said, what can be reported, how you can report it. There'll be state-sanctioned groups, but if you're outside of the state-sanctioned religions, you will be at the receiving end of crackdowns, detentions, and this rising kind of unofficial and perhaps officially sanctioned violence. So it's really an unease with an independent civil society sector and activity and groups they can't control.
We got an email from a listener who says he spent 6 months living in Xinjiang. He speaks fluent Chinese and some Uyghur. He said, most of my closest friends during the time were Uyghurs, and I think most people agree that the Uyghurs will never have an independent state within China's current borders. From my observations, it seems that one of the biggest problems facing the Uyghurs in China is that because Xinjiang is an autonomous zone, Uyghur children are educated in the Uyghur language. While this may seem like a good idea, it makes it very difficult for the bulk of Uyghur children to fully integrate in Han Chinese society because they are functionally illiterate. Every Uyghur I know with wealth or influence would secure a place for their child in the Chinese schools.
That is a huge tension that's created for ethnic minority groups, particularly the Uyghurs and the Tibetans. And that is, to speak Chinese, they need Han Chinese, they need Putonghua to advance. However, at the same time, it is state policy and its human rights obligation to ensure the survival and the integrity of a culture, including its language and its religion and its history. So that's the tension, is that it's an obligation. It's not a choice. It's both an international obligation, and it is domestic Chinese policy to preserve the diversity and the integrity of these groups. At the same time, the reality is that there's discrimination. The reality is it's very difficult to be educated in one language. We know that in this country as well. Bilingual education presents very complex problems. These questions need to be addressed. And the problem with addressing these questions is we need greater transparency and accountability from the government in order to address these questions. And in the citizens and people themselves within China need to be able to address these questions without being branded as criminals and detained for raising these issues of language and cultural identity.
Blaine, did the Uyghurs you spoke with want to become part of the Han Chinese society, especially the younger ones?
It depended on who I spoke with. You know, speaking of language, a number of the Uyghur I interviewed believed that the first critical step to drawing the Uyghur into the dominant society was to eliminate the practice of teaching classes in the Uyghur language. But the problem is the Chinese government on this one, they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't. Because if they eliminate the practice of teaching in Uyghur, then there are going to be Uyghur who complain, we don't have access to education in our native tongue, and that's discrimination. But if they continue to teach in Uyghur, now you're forcing these people to it takes them longer to become fluent, or if they learn it at all, in the dominant language of the society, and that limits their opportunities. As far as Uyghur wanting to join the dominant society, I would say, in general, the only goal which Uyghur shared with Chinese, certainly those Uyghur that weren't professionals and hadn't already assimilated, was, you know, the want for economic wealth. I think most of them wanted to have their own society with their own norms and cultural mores, and weren't as interested in becoming part of Chinese society. You know, they liked Uyghur food, they liked Uyghur music, they liked Uyghur entertainment, and they weren't interested in becoming a part of the society.
How are you able to go there and speak candidly with so many people?
I'm sorry?
How are you able to go there and speak candidly with so many people?
Well, I'm fluent in Mandarin, and you know, I did this without the aid of an interpreter or anyone helping me. I think because I'm not ethnically Chinese, and people were pretty open with me. They weren't afraid of any sort of reciprocity from talking with me. And I found that both Uyghur and Han were very open and friendly and easy to talk to. I was able to conduct conversations with taxi drivers, teachers, you know, anyone on the street.
Sharon, you wanted to add something?
I think this is first, I hadn't said this before, that it's a very important underreported topic this week, particularly in light of the whole media focus on the one-year countdown on the Olympics. And it is extremely important to maintain a focus so that it doesn't get too tunnel vision on 2008, that these the human rights issues, the massive social justice issues that are raised by looking at the situation of the Uyghurs predates the 2001, when China, by the way, also got the Olympics. But it also will be an issue that the 30,000 journalists who will be going to cover the Olympics, mostly sports journalists, really ought to be on the lookout for beyond the open the aperture and say, well, what else is going on in China while the games are going on? What is going on in the XUAR during the games? What crackdowns? What kind of locking down? What kinds of detentions are occurring? What is happening particularly under the rubric of, you know, an open People's Olympics, a Green Olympics? And we hadn't even talked about the environmental problems in the XUAR and in the Tibetan autonomous regions.
Well, Tibet gets a lot more attention because there are many people in this country who are followers of the Dalai Lama, people like Richard Gere. But the Uyghurs are pretty much underrepresented. The only time we hear about them is if a number of them are taken from Guantanamo and dumped in Albania rather than sent back to China. So what about Uyghurs if they want to get out of China? Can they seek political asylum elsewhere?
Well, you have the cautionary tale of Hussein Salil, you know, who did get out of China and escaped and was given political asylum as a refugee in Canada and in 2001. And when even after Salil received his Canadian citizenship, he was a Canadian citizen, and he traveled back to Uzbekistan on a Canadian passport to visit his wife's family in 2006. He's picked up by the police in Uzbekistan and extradited to China. And as we know, the trial, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment, deprived of political rights for allegedly engaging in terrorist activities. And in July, just past July, his appeal has been rejected by the Chinese courts, and the Canadian embassy officials were barred from his hearing. So this is a very, very strong, powerful warning that even if you escape and have received refugee status, that does not necessarily mean that you will be outside of the long arm of the Chinese public security forces.
Blaine, when you spoke to Uyghurs, did they think much about the upcoming Olympics?
Particularly in Beijing, I think most of the Uyghurs were very excited about that. Especially, you know, Beijing, I found most of the Uyghurs there had assimilated. They spoke Han Chinese. Many of the Uyghurs there were second, third generation who had, you know, they may have gone back to Xinjiang to visit, but for them, they considered Beijing to be their home. And they were excited about the Olympics coming up, and they were planning on rooting for China. Now, Uyghur in Xinjiang, on the other hand, I think a lot of them may root for other teams. They weren't as interested in it. They don't think it benefits them.
The Olympics has to be viewed in the context of the fact that major PR firms, Hill & Knowlton, Ogilvy, were hired by the Beijing Olympics Committee to package it. So a lot of the nationalistic fervor is in part, of course, shared because of the nationalism generally in China. But the second thing is it's absolutely a product of a very, very high-end media packaging. Playing your point about the Uyghurs in the cities really underscores the urban-rural split. You know, if you look at it another way, yes, when we say, what do people think, or is it benefiting, and is the growth, is there more openness, can you talk about, what do they think about the Olympics, what you really see is that split. It's 700 million rural inhabitants are out of the picture. And, that's not talking to, say, the migrants, not the assimilated, the ones living in migrant shantytowns, or the 1 million migrant workers who are building the Olympic venues, who are all, the question is, what's going to happen to them? Their shantytowns are already being dismantled now. So I think that the Olympics raises the very important question of, how are we going to get the story right? How, in addition to keeping it as an underreported, how do we get it to be a reported story. How do we understand what's going on to the whole populations and the people living within China's borders? What is going to happen to the Uyghurs in the lead up and the starting of military exercises, for example, doesn't bode well. I mean, the Shanghai Cooperation, committees starting the big exercises in the region is a lot of saber rattling, and that doesn't seem to be a good indication of a peaceful, People's Olympic, Green Olympics. So I think the Olympics is a good vehicle to keep a focus on these issues. At the same time, we need to be thinking now that these issues are deep, complex, and will also go beyond 2008.
And we will continue following them on our show. And my great thanks to both of you for being with us. Sharon Hom, Executive Director of Human Rights in China. There is a link to Human Rights in China's website on our show page. You could read more about the Uyghurs and other human rights issues in China there. Also with us, Blaine Kaltman, author of a recent book from Ohio University Press called Under the Heel of the Dragon, Islam, Racism, Crime, and the Uyghur in China. Thank you both so much for being with us today on Underreported.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.